It's my pleasure to be welcomed onto the Grand Ark Conspiracy, the author of the book Villains, Scoundrels, and Rogues, Incredible True Tales of Mischief and Mayhem, and he is also the author of the book Secret Heroes. Paul Martin is joining us tonight on the Grand Ark Conspiracy, and we're going to be touching on those two books as we go through the evening. Welcome to the Grand Ark Conspiracy, Paul. It's a pleasure to have you on the program.
Well, thank you very much, Daniel. Good to be here.
So I saw the Villains, Scoundrels, and Rogues, and I thought, oh my gosh, this is going to be a fantastic book to read, and it was. And then I found out about the Secret Heroes book that you wrote as well. I haven't had the opportunity to read that one, but it seemed like these were companion pieces that were to be kind of put together as a set so you could get to see the good and the bad of the history that of these kind of forgotten or not even understood when in their own time individuals that kind of helped shape the landscape for us.
Well, that's really true. What I did, the way these evolved, I worked for National Geographic for 30 years, and toward the end of my tenure there, I was getting ready to retire in 2009, and I had an idea for a long time. I've always been a history buff, and I've always been fascinated by characters that I've come across that I'd never heard of and who'd done some really strange or wonderful thing, either good or bad. And I had kept a file on those over the years, so when I did retire in 2009, I started writing a series of, basically they were magazine articles. They were 2,500 to 3,000 words in length, and I had almost 40 of these pieces, and I thought, well, this is a book. So I sent them to an agent, and the agent liked them, and the first thing she said, though, is you have to give this some sort of shape, because it was a mishmash of heroes and villains, and so most of the characters I'd written about were had positive accomplishments. So the first book I did, I put together a collection called Secret Heroes, Everyday Americans Who Shaped Our World, and I had 30 characters in that book, and they ranged from Kirk Bloodsworth, who was the first death row inmate to be tested for DNA, which ended up freeing him, and he went on he's still alive, he's still working on behalf of people wrongly imprisoned. I came up with the character Jonathan Letterman, who was the man who, and during the Civil War, evolved the entire concept of battlefield casualty management. He's the man who came up with what we knew as MASH, the Mobile Army Surgical Hospital. I mean, he invented all of that during the Civil War. So there's just a whole range of people. And when I got done with that, I thought, there were a few characters that I'd written pieces on that weren't quite so good. And I thought, well, it'd be fun to do an entire collection of scoundrels, of people who'd done things that weren't heroic. And it did evolve as a sort of counterbalance. I had the heroes collection. I thought, well, it'd be cool to have a collection of villains, scoundrels, and rogues. So that's how that evolved.
So keeping it with the secret heroes, I mean, a lot of people would look at the list, and they can go out to PaulMartinBooks.com and check out, because you've compiled a list out there on the website of some of the individuals that are included in the book, kind of like a who's who of the kind of forgotten important people that made a positive impact on our history. And you know, most of these names are not ones that you're going to recognize, and it's one of those things when you really kind of look at history, we usually just hold on to the big names and kind of forget all the small names that came along, even though it doesn't necessarily reflect the impact they had long term or things like that. And there's also a few people in there that I was kind of surprised to see that might have been famous for one thing, but really their long term impact was something else other than what they were famous for.
Hedy Lamarr is a classic example of that. She was famous as an actress, but what people don't know is that she was a brainy inventor, and she was really the inspiration for the technology that has evolved into cell phones and all kinds of wireless communication. She proposed a torpedo guidance system in World War II that had a mechanism that would allow radio guidance of these torpedoes, and by quickly changing the frequency of the radio signals, the enemies couldn't pick that up and evade the torpedoes, which is what happened traditionally with the previous generation of weapons. And that changing, rapid changing in frequency, which was called frequency hopping, it's actually the technology behind cell phones. So while everyone knows her as a, you know, sexy, glamorous actress, what her lasting contribution really is this scientific accomplishment.
So how often when you looked into these people, was it that you found something that you totally didn't kind of expect out of their background, or was it just things that you kind of stumbled upon and then felt like it was necessary to bring out to the public arena?
Well, what I did on the Secrets book, I had, as I said, quite a list of characters, but I also, when I did retire and decide to focus entirely on this project, I contacted over 100 college history professors. I picked two universities in every state and sent them an email. I picked different disciplines, Civil War historians, the Progressive Era, women's rights, so forth, so I'd have a broad range of input. And I just asked them, who do you think is the most overlooked and unsung hero in American history? And I got about 36 replies back, and I think I ended up using 8 of their suggestions. So I had that input, and then I had, you know, my own collection. And so I started sorting through them and trying to organize them in some way, and I came up with a division of three. I have what I call voyagers, which are people who undertook some sort of either physical or mental or spiritual journey during their life that changed them. And the next character category was innovators, and of course that's mostly inventors and trailblazers of one sort or another. And the last category was humanitarians, people who really tried to do something for their fellow man. So I had those three divisions, and that helped me organize the book and select people that had real differences, because you want to see how people have accomplished something in a heroic way in all different manners. I mean, when we think of heroes, most people think of like a soldier on a battlefield rescuing a buddy, and that is heroic. Of course, that's a physical risking your life to save somebody, but it's sort of a short term thing. I was looking for heroism that lasted, that had a widespread impact. For instance, the man that General Eisenhower credited with winning World War II for us was a character named Andrew Jackson Higgins, and he was a boat builder down in New Orleans, and he was the person who invented the landing craft, that famous landing craft with a drop-down bow that soldiers would rush out of on beaches like Iwo Jima and on D-Day in Europe. And he invented that technology, the shallow draft boat that could get up on the beach without getting stuck. He saved thousands of lives because previously men had to jump out into deep water and kind of swim ashore, and, you know, they risked being shot for a much longer period of time before they could get up onto the beach. I mean, Higgins had a huge impact, totally unsung hero. There was a character, most people know of the Navajo code talkers in World War II, but what they don't know is that there were Native American code talkers in World War One. They were Choctaw Indians, and in World War One, they were the first code talkers. The Germans were able to break all of the American and European allies' codes, and one day an officer happened to overhear these two Choctaw Indians, army privates, talking in their native language, and he thought, wow, that would fool the Germans. And so they found 18 Choctaw Indians that were serving overseas at the time, and they made them into the first code talkers. And nobody knew about them because they made them promise after the war to not tell even their families, because they thought they might need this kind of secret weapon again in the future. And, of course, they did in World War II. So there's just all kinds of wonderful unsung hero stories that whenever I find them, I really get excited about them. And really, when I wrote about these were all very personal selections. You know, I had to find somebody that I thought was, you know, really a gee whiz story that I wanted to spend, you know, several weeks with getting to know and writing about. So it's a very personal collection.
Well, it's one of the fascinating things about history for myself, and I'm a history buff as well, is that it's these stories that really kind of drive me towards, you know, reading about history, to learning more about history. I mean the big battles and all of that, the wars and things like that, they're interesting, but it's these small things and how individuals can impact a great deal of people, either for the good or for the bad. It's when you look at these individual stories to where I think history really begins to have life breathed into it.
I think so, and I tried to tell these as very personal stories. I kept focused on the person, and I tried to let history come in through telling their story, what they did. One of my favorites in the Secret Heroes book was a character named Hercules Mulligan, and I have to be honest, I picked him out, or I originally focused on him solely because of that interesting name. When I was trying to find heroes, I thought, I wonder who the first American was that ever was awarded a military medal. And I investigated, and I found that it was in the Revolutionary War that George Washington had presented the first medal to a spy named Daniel Knipp. Unfortunately, he disappeared from history, and I only found like a paragraph of information about the man. But while I was investigating this, I ran across this name, Hercules Mulligan, and I thought, ooh, that's really a cool name. Turns out he was an Irish immigrant who came to New York, and he became a tailor. And his tailor shop was very popular with the British officers and with British businessmen in New York at the time of the Revolution. And when the war started, Mulligan was recruited to be a spy for General Washington, and he naturally agreed. And the reason he left Ireland was because of the British policies in Ireland, which discriminated against Catholics, and so he had no love for the British. And he ended up discovering two plots against General Washington by chatting to the customers in his shop, and very likely saved Washington's life. So. But nobody's heard about the guy. He's just absolutely unheard of. And to think of what he did, the impact he had on American history, it was so great. So those are the kind of stories I really loved writing about.
Now, with Hercules Mulligan, I've got to wonder if, as a spy, I mean, he was definitely at risk. I mean, did that affect his personal well-being? I mean, whether that's even... you know, the British finding out and...
Oh, it did. He was arrested three times, and he was, as I said in the book, he had the gift of gab, and he actually just talked himself out of those charges on three different occasions. And he ended up marrying the niece of a British admiral. She was quickly converted to the American cause, too, so he didn't have to worry about that. And at one point, they took in as a boarder a young student who'd come up from the Caribbean named Alexander Hamilton. And Alexander Hamilton, at that point, was very pro-British. And Hercules Mulligan converted him to the American cause. So he just did all of these amazing things. And he's not written about in any history textbooks. He's not, there aren't any monuments to him. It's just amazing how he's been overlooked.
So, for you, this required a lot of digging, I would imagine. There's got to be really difficult to uncover the history of the people. I mean, you might be able to find a mention or two on the mainstream level, you know, but more like footnotes. How is it that you were able to kind of uncover this information? I mean, is it out there, or is it the genealogies?
It's out there, but it's buried, and it's... I liken the research for these characters as like a treasure hunt or a mystery that you're trying to solve, because Often when I go on, you know, on the internet and I would Google somebody's name, I would find a few vague mentions or a few references. But sometimes you'll find references to books. And of course, I live in Washington, D.C. area, and the greatest asset we have here is the Library of Congress. And I spent, you know, I don't know how many days, hours, weeks down there researching these characters, finding original documents and old books that hadn't been checked out for years and years that had some mention, maybe a paragraph or maybe a chapter. And you just piece these things together and try to come up with the true story, which is, for anyone writing about history, the hardest thing on earth to do is to winnow through all the previous things that have been written or documented, because every time, it's like the old parlor game, you know, every time a story is told, something gets changed and there's contradictions. I mean, in reliable sources, you would find contradictory dates, contradictory spellings of names or places. So it's really a process of weighing and balancing and trying to get as many resources as you can to make the right decision.
Well, you know, that goes with the old adage, when the legend becomes fact, print the legend. And you have to kind of dig to get the true story, because a lot of times with characters in history, you notice that they become legendary and there become stories and they might be embellished a bit, or they might even be completely fabricated about the individual. So it's understandable.
Well, and sometimes the individuals do the fabricating themselves. For instance, the character in the hero's book, Jimmy Angel, he was the man who discovered what came to be known as Angel Falls in Venezuela, which is the highest waterfall in the world. And he was an inveterate tailspinner. He embellished his career to no end. He told all sorts of yarns about what he'd done. And he really didn't need to, because his life was so amazingly colorful that he didn't have to do this. But he was, I guess, just a pathological storyteller. But you know, that there's a case where you can't always rely on what a character themselves have said. You have to sort of weigh and balance. Again, it's like checking all the different sources and trying to find the path that is the truest.
I got to imagine, as a historian, that's probably the most difficult task you have is winnowing it all the way down to something that is as true as possible. I mean, because the further we get away from something, the murkier the water gets as far as, you know, what actually happened. And a lot of these things have less and less sources. They just kind of get lost through history, or through the passage of time. So it's interesting that you were able to kind of unearth all the information that you were about these individuals, even though they were pretty big at the time. A lot of them were pretty large, loomed largely at the time of what they were doing. For whatever reason, things get lost over
the past. Well, yeah, and one of the great resources, again, the Library of Congress, is they have complete microfilms and now computerized copies of newspapers, you know, back to the 1800s, all over the country. So virtually anyone that has had any kind of notoriety at some point in their life, you can go back and find articles written about them at the time. So you don't have to depend on modern books and periodicals. You can go back and find really, really old material.
So looking at the older material, the newspapers and stuff, I mean, I know the media gets a lot of flack for its content nowadays because of the fact-checking and all of that and how quickly things need to come out during a news cycle. But back then, I think it's interesting when I look at an older newspaper, especially something like, you know, 1910 and back, is that the fact that I don't see a huge difference between then and now, you know, because the story still needed to get out, and the way that people had to go out and get the stories, well, it was a lot harder journey for them now. They didn't have cell phones. They didn't have all these other modern conveniences that we do now. They had to either go out and ask as many people as possible and bring it back and print it, or they had to kind of make it up on their own as well.
Well, I have a master's degree in journalism, and I've studied the history of journalism, and I'll tell you this, that I don't know if there was a golden age of journalism when everyone was accurate and honest, because the early newspapers were outrageous in terms of exaggeration and just making up facts, because when newspapers began, the big thing was to sell them, and that's why they would come up with preposterous stories about men on the moon and all sorts of things just to shock people and to try to sell newspapers. So again, while there's a lot of old source material available, again, you've got to kind of weigh and balance, because they were just as interested in 100 years ago in pushing their product as journalists seem to be today.
Well, that's kind of what I was getting at, because it doesn't seem to me like there's actually a huge difference. I just, for whatever reason, it's human nature to look back on, at a different time and say, well, that was better. You know, that they actually, but you know, and you hear so many people complaining about the news today and all of that, but it was the same back then. I mean, you know, you had people like Hearst and other individuals trying to sell their newspapers, or the bias was there one way or the other, to the left or the right, or
Oh, of course.
you know.
And the period you mentioned, 20s and 1910s and on earlier, politics played such a huge part in news reporting. I mean, there were newspapers totally dedicated to pushing one party. And of course, the people who read that were loyal to that party. So it's an amazing part of our history. And it's part of the fun of researching, is just to see the perspective of people talking about events in their day, and to sometimes have a better perspective today, because you've seen what really had transpired, and you can see how biased they were. I'm sure years from now, people will be looking at the coverage in newspapers and online today and see the same phenomenon. So, again, it's like the parlor game. You've got to decide what the who the source is and what is their vested interest.
Well, it is. It's a time capsule to some degree. I mean, when you look at the attitudes about the individuals they're reporting on, you kind of understand how they fit into the culture at large at that time, if you understand where the newspaper or the article is coming from. Because, yeah, I mean, there definitely was slanted bias, and has been since we've had the printed word and used it as a news source. So that is something that I don't think will ever fall by the wayside. I think it's something that's always been with us, but we like to fool ourselves into thinking that, we were pure at one time, which I don't think is the case.
I don't know when that period was.
Yeah, right. Well, when the historian who unearths that, well, they'll definitely get to be a big name themselves, because that.
Yeah, I think that period might have lasted maybe 2 or 3 days.
And I think people were on vacation resting at the time. So,
Right.
we're talking with Paul Martin. We're talking about secret heroes and villains, scoundrels, and rogues with him. You can go out to granddarkconspiracy.com to link up to his website, paulmartinsbooks.com. You can do that, during the break or whenever, and you'll be able to see the list of characters included in both these books and also the other books that he's written. And you can also link up to the secret heroes and villains, scoundrels, and rogues by going to granddarkconspiracy.com, clicking on the links that I have up there for you, and you'll be able to go into Amazon and get the book there. We're going to go ahead and take our first break, and when we come back, we'll continue the conversation with Paul on the other side.
Thank you. This is Ian.
And I'm Doc.
You can listen to us every weekday morning from 6 until 9.
Right here on True Oldies QT 1270.
Be honest. Will owning a bigger TV help you get ahead in life? Will another pair of shoes make you a better person? Probably not. But what if you could speak another language? If acquiring a new language excites you more than acquiring more stuff, then wait until you hear this. As part of its biggest language learning event in history, Rosetta Stone is giving away demos of its powerful language learning software absolutely free. For your free demo, call 1-800-355-7616. And Rosetta Stone has made language learning more convenient than ever. Learn on your computer or iPad, then practice on the go with your smartphone or MP3 player without ever opening a book or memorizing boring vocabulary again. Do you want more stuff, or do you want a language that will last a lifetime? After all, it's all about priorities. To try a free demo of this powerful language learning software, call 1-800-355-7616. Again, get your free demo now. 1-800-355-7616. That's 1-800-355-7616.
8. I deliver your Sunday paper every week.
7. We work on the same floor.
1 in 8 Americans is struggling with hunger.
6. Our kids walk to school together every day,
including millions of children and seniors.
5. We chat in the elevator at work sometimes.
4. I'm your cashier at the grocery store.
Who's the 1 in 8 in your life that needs help? You can make a difference through Feeding America at feedingamerica.org/1in8. A public service announcement brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
I have a passion for the environment. That's why I serve in the United States Coast Guard. We monitor commercial vessels, making sure our ports and waterways are safe and clean from oil or other hazardous material. We patrol our fisheries, protect marine wildlife and their habitats. With all we do, it's about protecting America.
Were you born ready to protect America? Learn more at GoCoastGuard.com.
Sponsored by the United States Coast Guard in cooperation with the Ohio Association of Broadcasters and this station.
My name is Tom Thornton.
And my name is Cindy Thornton. We're retired, and this is how we live United.
We decided to volunteer with United Way at our community free health clinic.
United Way is how we contribute, because we know our time and money are going to the right places.
Judging by the thank yous we get at the clinic, I'd say we're doing the right thing with our retirement, too. We're Tom and Cindy Thornton. We volunteer at our community free health clinic. We don't just wear the shirt.
We live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer. Live United. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Far from the city, where the Lorax roams free, is the home of the magical truffula trees. In a place you will love, with things you'll adore us, it's a magical spot. We call it the forest.
Everyone here needs the trees.
And who are you?
I'm the Lorax.
Guardian of the forest.
The forest is there for you to explore. So come once to see it, then come back lots more.
I just like hearing you say it.
Visit discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
From True Oldies 1270 WQTT, here is your Marysville area weather bug forecast. For the rest of the morning, we'll have clear skies at a low of 45. Heading into Veterans Day, there's a chance of afternoon showers. It'll be mostly sunny, our high 64, with winds over 15 miles an hour. Showers are likely Tuesday evening. It'll be mostly cloudy and cool overnight with a low of 33, with winds to 15 miles an hour. Wednesday should be mostly sunny with a high of 41. Again, for this morning, we'll have clear skies at a low of 45. For True Oldies 1270, I'm Rod Tanner.
Don't stop running. Let's be sunlight. Let's be heroes. Let's be different. Let it all be right. Let's be sunlight. Let's be heroes. Let us win. It's mediocrity.
And we're back. We're talking villains, scoundrels, and rogues, and secret heroes with the author, Paul Martin. And you want to go out to grandarkconspiracy.com. Links are up to his website, paulmartinbooks.com. And also, links are up for you to get a copy of both the books that we've been discussing tonight. So, the villains, scoundrels, and rogues. Secret heroes was kind of singular. You know, you had heroes. You've kind of separated out in villains, scoundrels, and rogues the individuals into different categories of nefariousness.
I did. I tried to... the way this evolved was when I decided to write about villains or bad guys, I quickly, as I started researching it, I saw that the bulk of material that you find, most of the books, it seems, are about the most horrendous crimes, you know, axe murders and serial killers and so forth and so on. And those quickly get pretty cloying, pretty tiring, and you want them. I wanted to find a complete range of villainy, and so the first thing I did is I sat down and I made up a list of all the kinds of, you know, wrongdoers I could come up with: assassins, bootleggers, forgers, gangsters, murderers, outlaws, perjurers, smugglers, vigilantes, counterfeiters, traitors, Wall Street crooks. You know, everything I could think of, and I made this list. And the next step was I tried to find the most colorful, interesting example of each one of those categories. And when I had this, I had this long list of potential people to write about, and again, I realized I needed, much as I had done in Secret Heroes, I needed some way to organize the book. And so the first thing that occurred to me was, well, why don't you organize it according to their relative badness? And that's why I came up with the categories villains, scoundrels, and rogues. And just to quickly define, villains they're the worst of the lot. They are the killers and the murderers, the habitual wrongdoers. And scoundrels are a little bit less onerous. They are guilty of some serious crime. And rogues were the least bad of the three levels. They might have had some minor offense or some personal mistake that had some lasting consequence. So when I had that hierarchy, again, it was like the old treasure hunt, trying to find the most interesting, colorful character in each of these categories. And I wanted something. The characters had to have something besides just this crime or this one deed they did. I was looking for people who had some interesting life story behind them, some colorful background. I'll give you an example. When I looked into counterfeiters, now there are counterfeiters who have made you know, thousands and thousands of dollars in profits with their counterfeiting. But the one that stuck out when I looked into this subject was a character named Emmerich Jutner. He was the man who eluded authorities, the counterfeiter who eluded authorities longer than any other forger in history. And it wasn't because he was a clever career criminal. He actually was a retired New York City building superintendent and junk collector. And what happened was, when he got old and he was in his 60s and his wife had died, and he could no longer keep up his duties as a building superintendent, it happened that when he was a young man back in Austria before he immigrated to the United States, he had studied photo engraving. And so one day he sat down when he was 63 years old, sat down in his kitchen in his little apartment in New York, and he did a printing plate of a $1 bill. Can you imagine that? A $1 bill. And that was all he ever counterfeited, was $1 bills. And that's why he went so long. He went 9 years without being caught, because nobody would expect someone to be passing dollar bills. I mean, everybody, you know, they're used to 20s and 100s and so forth from counterfeiters. And the only reason he would go out with these little $1 bills, he'd like go to the subway and buy a 5 cent. This was back in the 1940s and 50s. He'd go to the subway, for instance, and buy a 5 cent fare and use one of his fake dollar bills, and he'd get back 95 cents in real money. And that was his score for the day. He could go buy something to eat, you know, and feed his little pet dog and so forth. And he ended up, he passed around 5,000 of these fake dollar bills in New York City. And he never went to the same place twice because he didn't want to victimize someone and take, you know, too much money away from him. So he was kind of a crook with a conscience. And eventually, the interesting thing, he got caught because there was a fire in his apartment. And when the firemen came, to put out the blaze, they threw a bunch of his stuff out the window into an alley behind the apartment building. What had happened, they threw out his printing plate and some of his counterfeit $1 bills, and some little kids found them, some boys, and they took the fake money home and used it for playing poker. And one of the fathers of one of these kids noticed what they were playing with. He looked at it, and he realized it was a counterfeit dollar bill, so he took it to the police, and they traced it back to that apartment. And that's how this Emmer Studner was finally caught. And he was such a harmless, if you will, doddering old guy, that they sentenced him to a year in jail. He only served 4 months, and when he got out, he went to live with one of his daughters, and that was the end of his criminal career. But that story, to me, was so much more interesting than reading about some mafia character who forged $100 bill plates and passed thousands and thousands of dollars. I just thought this was such an interesting human story.
Well, it definitely kind of paints a picture of how these people are human beings. I mean, even though, you know, we like our villains to be sociopathic or psychopathic, so we can kind of put them over in a corner and say they're different than us, this is distinctly human. This is something that all of us could kind of identify with. You're an individual put in an extreme situation who doesn't really does what he has to survive to some degree, but doesn't really abandon completely his conscience or his morals. I mean, just did what he could, but didn't take more. I mean, it doesn't sound like it was a thing of greed, but more it was a necessity for his survival.
Exactly. In his case, and of course, he was in the rogues category. He was the mildest offender. And in the villains category, the heinous criminals, I do have a couple of people who fit that stereotype of the psychopath. Two of them in particular, Ed Gein and Belle Gunness. These two characters were, stark raving mad. The thing about Ed Gein, to go back to what I said earlier, you can find books and books about these kinds of characters who just did horrendous crimes. But again, what was it that made them stand out? Well, in Ed Gein's case, he was the man whose crimes inspired basically a whole genre of movies, slasher movies. He inspired the movie Psycho, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and Silence of the Lambs. Ed Gein was in the 1940s and 50s. He was a handyman in Wisconsin. Lived in a farm out the edge of a little town, Plainfield, Wisconsin. And he was a mama's boy, and he lived with his mother after the father had died, a brother had died, and it's suspected that Ed killed his brother because he wanted his mother's full attention. And he and his mother lived in this little farmhouse, and when she died, she had a couple of strokes and passed away. He just basically went off the deep end, and he wanted to become a woman himself, but he didn't have any money. He didn't have, couldn't afford to go to Sweden and have a sex change operation, as was happening at the time. So he, this is really ghoulish and this is really sick. He started digging up recently buried women and cutting off parts of their body. And he would take these home, and he made them into a woman suit. Now, this is where we get the Silence of the Lambs. That's where they got the idea. He was taking body parts, tanning them and making them into, like, skins, and he made a woman suit. And he would wear this thing around his house. And he was just an abomination, just an absolute nut job. He murdered two women. Most of the body parts he harvested from women who'd just recently been buried, but he did kill two women. And he was finally caught when, in 1957, he killed the owner of a hardware store in his hometown, and they traced, the police found that he had been in that store that afternoon, so they went out to his farmhouse to interview him. They didn't suspect anything at that point. He was one of the last people to see her. And they discovered this horrid collection of body parts and skulls, and all. It was just horrible. And, of course, he was tried and put away for the rest of his life. He was in psychiatric institutions for the rest of his life. But those terrible, terrible crimes inspired the character of Norman Bates in Psycho, who, you know, kept his dead mother upstairs, and it also inspired the character of Leatherface in the Chainsaw Massacres, because as awful as it sounds, Ed Gein would take these women's faces that he'd cut off from bodies in the cemetery and make masks out of them. I mean, he was as creepy as any human being could possibly be. So what really stood out to me about him was that this one individual basically inspired an entire genre of movies, the slasher franchise movies. So he had a huge impact beyond the murders that he committed. It was like I don't think any screenwriter, any scriptwriter in Hollywood would have ever conceived of the horrible types of crimes that he committed. I mean, it took reality to inspire fiction.
Yeah, Ed Gein is a very disturbing character, to be sure. He was pretty awful. And the crimes that he committed. I mean, that was one of the things they're reading. And there was the other one you mentioned. I can't remember her name. It just
Belle Gunness.
That was another one. Which really kind of blew me well, and it drew parallels to me of another individual who was around the Chicago area. And I kind of want to – we have to take a break here just for station identification real quick. I want to get into Bell, Soros, and Gunness after that break, all right?
WQTT Marysville. News, sports, weather, and great oldies all day long. Lock it on. True Oldies, QT 1270.
And we're back. Now we've got the station identification out of the way. We're talking Villains, Scoundrels, and Rogues with Paul Martin right now. And before we took that, Bell, Soros, and Gunness. This woman reminded me so much of, I don't know if you're familiar with H.H. Holmes, but this is exactly, it was exactly how he worked and operated. But this, and it's amazing that this was in Chicago as well.
It is, and yes, I am familiar with him. What really makes her stand out? Again, she was a psychopath and a serial killer. But what makes her stand out is she became, if not the first, certainly the most notorious lonely heart killer. She would tempt lonely bachelors to her farm in Indiana and do away with them. But intents and purposes, she was the worst female serial killer that we've ever had, at least that we know of. She may have killed over 40 men, 40 people, because what makes her even more heinous is she killed her own children. She killed two of her husbands, and she killed all seven of her children for insurance. She was a Norwegian immigrant, came to this country, came to Chicago, settled in the Chicago area at the turn of the 20th century, and she married, and she opened a candy store in Chicago, and it didn't thrive. And so she came up with a plan to burn it down and collect the insurance money. And when that paid off, she thought, this is a pretty good deal. And so she burned her own house down and collected the insurance money. Then she killed two of her infant children, and she killed her first husband. Her first husband she killed on the one day that two of his the life insurance policies she'd taken out on him overlapped. So on that one day, that was the day she killed him. She poisoned them all, by the way, with strychnine, which mimics some natural causes of death. And at the time, they didn't have very good system of autopsies and so forth. So she kept getting away with this, and they thought that, you know, her husband had died of natural causes and her children had died of natural causes. And so after she pulled these scams off in Chicago, she had the equivalent of over $300,000 in insurance money, in today's dollars. She went to LaPorte, Indiana, and bought a hog farm. And she remarried there, and her first husband didn't last a year. She killed him. And after she was through killing husbands, she decided that what she would do, she started advertising in Scandinavian newspapers that went out to immigrants, all across the U.S. and Canada who come here from Scandinavia. And she advertised, you know, that she was a wealthy widow with a nice farm in Indiana, and she was looking for a husband who was well provided for, and she wanted anyone who was serious in considering, you know, making a match to come visit her. Well, every time that a suitor would show up on her door, she'd feed him a dinner, drug him, and when they were passed out, she'd bash in their heads, and she buried them out in her backyard in the hog lot. Eventually, after so many people had disappeared, we're talking dozens of these people who came there and disappeared, some of the family members started making inquiries, you know, what the heck was happening to our loved ones? They go to this woman's house in Chicago or in Indiana, and nobody ever hears from them again. So she got alarmed that people were closing in on her, and she killed her last three children, killed her housekeeper, put them down in the basement, and burned the house down. And she was hoping that people would think that the housemaid was her, that she had died in the fire. Well, it turns out that the housemaid was much shorter, and so authorities realized it wasn't her. And she disappeared. Nobody knows what happened to her. She had withdrawn her money from the banks, and she just disappeared. So whatever had became of Belle Gunness is totally unknown.
At the same time, it's like I said, it's another significant thing is that she was a female serial killer. There's not a lot of female serial killers out there to begin with, in comparison to the male counterpart. But it's just reading that, the insurance scams, the killing of, the lonely heart kind of killings, it's interesting to me. I have to wonder if, and I'm sure this is not in history, if she had crossed paths with H.H. Holmes to some degree, because it so echoes what he did. I mean, he would do that. He would get lonely women, marry them, use the insurance money. He burned down several businesses and houses and...
I don't know whether none of the research that showed that would have happened, and I sort of doubt it. I mean, I don't think she had that kind of foresight or, you know, inquiring mind. I think she had her little scam, and it just happened to be kind of parallel to what he was doing. But what made her so, aside from her first of being like the first female lonely heart killer and most prolific female serial killer, what really stood out was her cruelty to her own family, that she would kill seven of her own kids. It's just amazing. I mean, obviously, at some point, that person is so unhinged that anything is possible, and that certainly was the case with Belle Gunness.
And the thing that makes it even that much more startling is how much more she did, because after she disappeared, I mean, we don't know what happened to her, where she ended up.
She may have killed another 30, 40 people. Nobody knows. There were rumors that she appeared in Los Angeles and in different places and under different names. People saw her. There were reports of her in Chicago being in the same, like, six different places at the same time. It just became such a, when the newspapers got a hold of it and all these bodies were dug up at our farm, they started finding all these skeletons. It became quite a sensational thing at the time. And so she was very well known, and people were wondering what happened to her, and there were all sorts of probably erroneous reports of her sightings, but they really never knew for sure what happened to her.
Well, you know, and that's the scary thing. I mean, and she kind of disappeared into the kind of into the ether of history as well. I mean, And that was one of the things, I'm sure it was the biggest story going at the time. I mean, like you said, the people were seeing her all over the place because, well, she was disappeared. So anybody that kind of even remotely matched her description, of course, was going to be her. She kind of like became a boogeyman for a while and then disappeared.
Exactly, exactly. And there was an odd phenomenon that, well, it happened with Ed Gein, too, and I wrote about this. There were, as odd as it sounds, fan clubs. I mean, and weird books that were published that sort of made these people seem like some, you know, kind of not hero, but some sort of antisocial character. There were books written about that based on the character of Belle Gunness. And I had to laugh. One of them I found in the Library of Congress, and it was a cover. And it was, the cover was what we now know as bodice rippers. It was this beautiful blonde woman with her, you know, blouse half ripped open. And this was supposed to be Belle Gunness. Well, Belle Gunness was plug ugly. She was not a beautiful woman, which I couldn't fathom how a woman of how she could attract so many men, but it was all anonymous. It was through the newspaper, so when they showed up, they probably were more impressed with her farm than with her. But these weird things after, I kind of think it's a coping mechanism. I think some of those people who were writing about Ed Gein in kind of frivolous ways, I think maybe they were scared to death and they were trying to, you know, get rid of this fear through some sort of joking manner.
Well, and that might be the case. We're talking with Paul Martin, Villains, Scoundrels, and Rogues is the book we're discussing right now. Earlier we were discussing Secret Heroes. Links are up for both those books at granddarkconspiracy.com. And links are up for Paul Martin's website, paulmartinbooks.com, as well. We're going to take a break here, and when we come back, we'll continue the discussion with Paul on the other side.
Listen to us every weekday morning from 6 until 9.
Right here on True Oldies QT 1270.
After thousands of years, after crippling millions of children, polio will soon be stopped forever. All over the world, people are joining the men and women of Rotary to end polio now. People like Jackie Chan and Jane Goodall.
We are this close.
This close.
People like Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
This close.
People like you. Be a part of history. Help Rotary end polio now at rotary.org/endpolio. We are this close.
Maybe it's time to take a fresh look at everything we thought we knew about landing a great job. For instance, perhaps great careers start at the middle school science fair instead of at the job fair. Because the fact is, the jobs of the future will be heavily geared towards science, technology, engineering, and math. In other words, STEM. So if you're a student, talk to your school counselor about STEM. If you're a parent, talk to your kids. A public service message from America's Navy.
On my first patrol, my adrenaline was pumping.
Always on high alert. After a while, it takes a toll. I was counting the days till I came home to my family. Finally, a day arrived.
But then I realized things were different.
I had trouble focusing and relating to things the way I used to. I decided to reach out.
Once I started making connections, things began to turn around.
Find resources and support at maketheconnection.net.
Make the connection.
At 4:15 p.m. at an office in Michigan, Angie Hicks is not at her desk. She's giving blood at the company blood drive.
At the same time in the same office, Kevin Meehan is not at his desk. He's at the doctor. Kevin has cancer and needs another round of chemo.
Kevin will need blood to fight his cancer.
Angie's blood will help him win.
When you give blood to the American Red Cross, you change a life.
Starting with your own.
Call 1-800-GIVE-LIFE or visit givelife.org to schedule your appointment to give blood.
From True Oldies 1270 WQTT, here is your Marysville area weather bug forecast. For the rest of the morning, we'll have clear skies at a low of 45. Heading into Veterans Day, there's a chance of afternoon showers. It'll be mostly sunny, our high 64. We'll have winds over 15 miles an hour. Showers are likely Tuesday evening. It'll be mostly hot and cool overnight with a low of 33 with winds to 15 miles an hour. Wednesday should be mostly sunny with a high of 41. Again, for this morning, we'll have clear skies at a low of 45. For True Oldies 1270, I'm Rod Tanner.
Was no proof, and I'm not afraid to die. And the mercy seat is glowing, and I think my head is smoking. And in a way, I'm hoping to be done with all these looks of disbelief. A life for a life, and a truth for a truth. And I've got nothing left to lose, and I'm not afraid to die. And the mercy seat is smoking, and I think my head is melting. And in a way that's helping to be done with all this twisting of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And anyway, I told the truth, but I'm afraid I told a lie.
Back. We've got Paul Martin on the line with us. We're talking Villains, Scoundrels, and Rogues with him. That's the book that we're discussing right now. Earlier, we were talking about Secret Heroes. Links are up at GrandDarkConspiracy.com for you to get yourselves a copy of those books, as well as to visit Paul's website. One of the things that I found very interesting in reading the book, and you kind of just alluded to that with Ed Gein and Belle Gunness, is that these people kind of become folk heroes, folk anti-heroes, or something like that. They kind of capture the imagination, and some people are, you know, I guess, enamored with these individuals to some degree. Like you said, it might be a coping mechanism to kind of help us deal with the atrocities that they committed and understand that.
That's the only thing I could come up with. Otherwise, the people who are celebrating these have a little bit of this, of sickness themselves going on, but I would attribute it more to if you're scared to death by something, you try to poke fun at it to take the terror away, and I think that's what some of this was.
You know, I think to some degree it is, you know, but then at the same time, some of these individuals you have in the book have somehow through, I don't understand, you become heroes to us, I mean, or sympathetic characters. I guess for, like, the murderers like Ed Gein and Belle Gunness, there's really kind of no, there's no redeeming qualities to them because they've kind of stripped away their humanity, and that's what allows them to do what they do. They're not really easy to empathize with because they don't have an emotional or moral baseline.
Definitely, but there are characters in the book like the Imrich Jutner, the counterfeiter. I mean, it's hard not to kind of chuckle when you hear the story about a little old man passing fake $1 bills. And by the way, they were reputedly the worst counterfeits ever. They were printed on typing paper. He misspelled George Washington's name. The picture of George Washington on the bill made him look Asian. I mean, they were just awful, awful counterfeit dollar bills. But there's also a couple of characters that I can think of that while I wouldn't call them heroic, if you don't admire them, you sort of feel like, well, what a colorful guy. Alvin Thomas was one character. He was better known as Titanic Thompson. He was the most famous gambler in the 1920s through the 1940s. And he actually became so famous that Damon Runyon wrote a story in which he based a character on Titanic Thompson, and that character was Skye Masterson, who became the principal character gambler in Guys and Dolls, the Broadway play. So, but Thomas was a compulsive gambler, and most of his gambling was on what's known as proposition bets. He would come up with crazy things that he would bet somebody he could do. For instance, he actually bet Al Capone that he could throw a walnut on top of a five-story building. He bet Capone $500, and he did it. But he had a walnut that was filled with lead, so it was much easier to throw. When he was a kid, he got his start with a really an ingenious proposition bet. He lived down in the Ozarks in Arkansas, and these city slickers would come down to fish in this one particular stream near his house. And Alvin Thomas had this dog that he had trained to retrieve rocks from the bottom of the stream, and he would bet these rich city fishermen that he could put a mark on a stone and throw it out in the stream, and his dog was so smart that he could go out there and find that exact rock and retrieve it. And he won that bet several times. But what he had done is he had thrown dozens of stones into the river with that same mark on them. So his dog was very likely to find a stone with that mark, you know, every time. Another thing he did once was he bet a golfer that he could hit his drive 500 yards, which, of course, you know, nobody can do. Even today, people, long drive competition, I think they maybe might reach 400. But what he did, and this was back in the 1920s, you know, this wasn't with modern equipment. He went out to a golf course in the middle of the wintertime to bet this guy to get up on the green, and instead of hitting this ball down the fairway, he turns to the side and hits it over onto this long frozen lake, and the ball just rolled forever on the ice. And so he won his bet. So he was so colorful that it's hard not to, if not admire the guy, at least sort of admire the craziness of some of the schemes he came up with.
Well, he was, yeah, he's one of those guys that I thought was very interesting. And the fact that he was willing to kind of, I don't know, how to play Capone.
He was pretty brave.
Pretty brave, because... You want to talk about a pretty scary character in history. That guy certainly was it. He was certainly mercurial. And if he had got any inkling that he had gotten, had someone gotten over on him, it wouldn't have turned out so well for Mr. Titanic Thompson.
No, it wouldn't. I think the funniest story about Titanic Thompson was he once bet the world champion horseshoe thrower, challenged him to a match. But he built Thompson built his own horseshoe pit. And what he did was he built it a foot longer than a regulation horseshoe pit, which is like 40 feet from one stake to the other. He built it 41 feet. And then he practiced until he got good at throwing a horseshoe for 41 feet. He challenges the world champion that comes there, and the world champion can't figure out why his throws keep coming up short.
So he was a guy that saw all the angles and kind of made a life out of that, trusting that other people maybe weren't seeing what he was doing behind the scenes.
Well, he did all that, and yet he was an amazing sportsman. He was reputed to be, in the 1920s, the world's best golfer. He beat Byron Nelson. Sam Snead said he, you know, couldn't believe how good this guy was, and he was ambidextrous. He didn't play on the, I mean, there wasn't a PGA at the time, but he didn't play on the professional circuit. I don't think there was a PGA. He didn't play with professionals on the regular circuit. He was a hustler. He would hustle up. He'd go to country clubs and challenge the local champ and so forth. And he would play a guy right-handed, And he never beat anybody by more than a stroke or two because he didn't want to discourage him. And when they would get done and he'd taken a guy's money, he'd say, I'll give you a chance to get your money back. I'll play left-handed next time. Well, of course, he was just as good left-handed, and he would win, left-handed. So he was a great golfer. He was apparently just an amazing athlete, did all kinds of things. But he loved to come up with these proposition bets, these outrageous bets where he would come up with, some seemingly impossible thing and take some money off of someone. I think he got more, well, he did say he got more fun and taking someone's money over some proposition bet that he'd come up with and invented than anything else. So I don't even think it was the money. It was just the thrill of winning one of those bets.
You know, I imagine that, for an individual like that, I mean, he kind of had, wishy-washy kind of morality and things like that. I mean, I know that he had scrapes with individuals that, he had to choose between himself or the other person continuing life. And obviously he continued on.
Referring to, he ended up, he killed, I think it was five or six men, all of whom were trying to rob him, and he famously said that they needed it. But he was self-preservation was number one with him. He carried his .45 everywhere he went, and if someone tried to, often these poker games and various things, they'd be in some dive down an alley somewhere, and when he was leaving, somebody would try to get their money back and rob him, and nobody ever succeeded.
But it's individuals like that we run into. I mean, even in today, I mean, that's the other thing, too. People want to think that the con game is dead, but it's really not. I mean, it's just kind of morphed and changed. I mean, we might not have these sting-like, which you mentioned with another character in the book.
Joseph Wheel, yeah.
Yeah.
The yellow kid. Yeah, he was a famous con artist, and he invented the con. The horse racing betting parlor con that was featured in the movie The Sting, he actually did that and took a lot of money off people. He was an interesting character because he never carried a gun. He was nonviolent, but he was a consummate con man. He came up with all sorts of ways to rip people off, and his main strength was he could impersonate a whole range of professional people. At different points, he would pass himself off as a stockbroker, a banker, a doctor, a mining engineer, chemist, geologist, so forth. And he always boned up and learned about those disciplines, so he could talk the talk, and he would get people interested in some scheme that he was pushing, and they thought he was for real. And he would take books that had been written by some expert, and he'd have a fake dust jacket made with his picture on it. He'd have it laying in his, lying out on the table in his office when he was trying to con someone. So, he was quite a con man.
But it's like we still have these individuals with us today. I mean, at least on the con, kind of like scoundrel, well, we have all of them with us today, honestly. But as far as the elaborate con games, it's one of those things that I don't know if it's something that's still prevalent today. But it's amazing to me to look at like the length and time went into these people to kind of make these things work, and I almost wonder if they had turned their energies to kind of like the people in the other book, to help other people rather than just kind of satisfy whatever they were trying to satisfy within themselves, whether it was just out and out greed, if they couldn't have done so much more for themselves and not had to run the risk of running afoul of an underworld or the law itself.
I'm sure that's the case. And as you phrased that, one of the characters springs right to mind, and that was John Brinkley. He was a doctor in Kansas. He operated from 1917 into the 1930s. He became fabulously rich through a a ridiculous medical procedure. He implanted goat testicles in men, trying to revive their potency. And of course, it was complete malarkey. It didn't. At most, it was a placebo. And if somebody thought they were more potent afterwards, that maybe it had some sort of psychological effect. But unfortunately, his procedure ended up killing 42 men because I don't think I'd want a goat testicle implanted in my body. I mean, they can't be that hygienic. And they developed sepsis and they developed blood poisoning and gangrene, and 42 men over this long period of years died in his clinic. And he was eventually run out of Kansas. They revoked his medical license, and he moved down to Del Rio, Texas. And one of the things that really, aside from the absurdity of this medical procedure that he was making all this money on, and I'm talking about in the 1920s, he was making like $2 million a year through these operations. And he had another scam. He started the first radio station in Kansas. And he used that to promote his procedure, but he also used it to promote another scam. He had what he called the medical question box, and people would write in with some complaints, something was wrong with them. He would actually prescribe medicine over the air. And, of course, you could only buy this in certain pharmacies, and unbeknownst to the listeners, it was pharmacies that agreed to give him a kickback. So he was making money, coming and going. They finally ran him out of town. He went down to Del Rio, Texas, and across the border in Mexico, he opened up established the first border blaster, which were those humongous radio stations, way more powerful than the federal regulations allowed. He could broadcast from Mexico all the way to Chicago. I mean, he could blast anyone out of the air. And that radio station introduced a lot of famous singers. Hank Williams used to appear on it. Wolfman Jack became one of the famous DJs down there in Del Rio from the Border Blasters. So he had a lot of impact. But eventually he sort of got a little too cocky, and the AMA had been after him for a long time, and he finally sued the editor of the AMA Journal, JAMA, J-A-M, Journal of American Medical Association. Well, when they got in an open courtroom, the prosecution or the lawyers for the AMA editor revealed all of his crooked shenanigans, all the people that had died. He was a bigamist. He had been married a couple of times and hadn't divorced his first wife. All these things came out, and it became evident he was a total quack, and his empire imploded, and within a few years he was bankrupt. But back to your point, if he had applied all of his ingenuity and medical abilities in a positive way, who knows what he could have done. But he chose to make money in this by pursuing this crazy operation that didn't help anyone. So it's a real mystery why somebody would choose to do one thing when they could have done, probably made a lot of money in a completely legitimate way.
Well, that's just it. I mean, it seems that on some of these, for some of these individuals, their ingenuity, had it been aimed in the right direction, would have been so much beneficial, so much more beneficial for themselves and the public at large. But for some reason, they kind of just began to skew a different way, whether that was someone like Fong Qing or any of the other characters in here. It's like they had the intelligence, they had the capability to kind of do great things without having to kind of be detrimental to people around them, but they still chose that path.
Joseph Weil, the yellow kid, he was sent to prison a couple of times. I think he served two or three different stretches, maybe about a total of 10 or 11 years. When he got out the last time, he was getting up there, I think he was in his 60s, and he decided he was going to go straight. And he became a fundraiser for some charitable organizations, and he was tremendously successful. I mean, he had the gift of gab. He could talk anybody into anything. So exactly as you said, if he had done that all his life, he could have been like, you know, Jerry Lewis on these marathon fundraisers or something. He could have done so much good, but that just wasn't his particular bent in life.
It's just interesting how, you know, and I know looking at these individuals, it's interesting to me to see how close it is to, how easy it is to skew one way or the other if we don't really have that kind of sturdy foundation to kind of guide us or to give us a guideline, to kind of find ourselves on the side of hurting people to helping people. I mean, it's not like it's this huge line, unless you're talking about the Ed Geins and other individuals who just out and out were murderous people. I mean,
right. Well, and there are some people who sort of drift into wrongdoing. And a classic example, I write about two sisters, Maggie and Kate Fox. They were, they actually inspired the spiritualism movement, the whole phenomenon in, after the Civil War up into the 1920s, after the World War One, there was a huge movement of spiritualism. I mean, it still exists today. There are still people who believe in spiritual mediums and so forth. But they were the ones who kicked this off, and they did it as a joke. As young girls, they were living with their parents in a farmhouse in Hinesville, New York. This was like in the 1840s. And it was wintertime, and they were housebound, and there was nothing to do, and they couldn't go out and play with their friends, and they were bored to death. And so they came up with the idea they were going to play a prank. The house that they were living in, there was supposedly a traveling salesman had been killed and buried in the basement. That was just an old legend. So they began to pretend at night after the family had gone to bed that the spirit of that traveling salesman was trying to contact them. And they when they went to bed, the parents would hear these bumping noises in the night, and they heard all sorts of cracking and popping noises. And Maggie and Kate Fox told their parents that it was the spirit of the dead traveling salesman contacting them. And so the parents called in some neighbors, and Maggie and Kate demonstrated how they could confer with the spirit. And the neighbors started asking questions, you know, is there an afterlife? Can we contact our dead loved ones, and so forth? And they would supposedly transcribe these noises and figure out, you know, what the spirit was saying. Well, before long, they became immensely famous, and they traveled all over the United States and in Europe, and they became the most famous spiritual mediums. They started this whole phenomenon that became so well established. I mean, Abraham Lincoln's wife, Mary Todd Lincoln, she believed in spiritualism. Arthur Conan Doyle, the man who wrote Sherlock Holmes, he believed in spiritualism. They believed firmly they could contact the spirits of their loved ones through these mediums. And what really gave impetus to this whole movement was the slaughter that took place in the Civil War and World War One, when so many people, hundreds of thousands of people, lost loved ones. And to have some hope that you could contact them through these mediums, just millions, I mean, literally millions of people believed in this. And, of course, it instantly became a huge scam. All kinds of people faking it that they were mediums and they could contact people and so forth. And, you know, every cliche you've seen in any movie or on TV about mediums and all their funny things with the lights and the tables moving, and they started that whole thing. And oddly, they kind of did, I mean, at the time they were, I think, 11 and 14 when this whole movement started. They became trapped. They didn't want to confess that it was a joke at first, and then it became so famous, and they became wealthy, and all sorts of things sort of drove them along in this direction. But then toward, as they became adults and had families, and sadly they both became alcoholics, and later on they just got sick of the whole thing, and they confessed that it was a complete hoax, that everything they had done, that they'd made these noises by cracking their knuckles or bouncing an apple on the floor in their farmhouse. But by that time, spiritualism was so entrenched, nobody believed them. They weren't willing to accept that this whole movement was based on a hoax. So I think when you talk about people making choices, whether their lives are headed in the direction of good or bad, these poor sisters, they were just sort of swept along. What started out as a joke ended up as a tragedy for them.
Well, they're a very fascinating case, and in particular, I mean, it's something that we do discuss on the show, is that exactly that kind of thing, and like with the spiritualist movement. I mean, you mentioned it proliferated after the Civil War, and then it boomed again in the 1918-1919 around World War I, and also the Spanish flu epidemic that happened that killed a lot of children
exactly.
in the United States.
Like Arthur Conan Doyle lost a son in the First World War, and that's how he got so interested in it. And I believe his first wife died too, and I think he thought he was able to contact her. So the whole movement preyed on people who were emotionally vulnerable, and you know, had this strong desire to contact their loved ones. And as I said in the book, in some ways, these spiritualists kind of provided some comfort for these people if they gave them this positive message and that their loved ones were okay in the afterlife and so forth and so on. But on the other hand, you know, they were doing it for money, and they were really taking advantage of them.
You really kind of end up with a whole league of scoundrels coming out of this kind of hoax that was perpetrated by the Fox sisters. Then, I mean, that's you know, it almost creates a whole new league of them. I mean, not to dismiss the possibilities of anything else that may happen, or the people that genuinely believe they're helping. I don't want to denigrate a whole.
No. I mean, I think there are people who get comfort out of it. But Harry Houdini, the famous magician, was one of the biggest debunkers of spiritualism, and he went to great lengths to prove that virtually every one of the so-called mediums were faking it. You know, he pulled the curtain away and exposed all the tricks they were using, all the you know the lights and the movement and everything. It was all fake. But
That was one of the things.
And interestingly, Harry Houdini and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle were close friends, and yet because Arthur Conan Doyle believed so strongly in spiritualism, and Houdini was so adamant that it was all fake, they actually fell apart. Their friendship was destroyed because of this two different viewpoints.
Right, the two different vantage points. Because I know Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, I would kind of put him in the true believer category on that topic, because he was so wanting and willing to believe just about anything that came down the road. He kind of threw out any kind of objectivity when looking at it, and with you mentioned Houdini, I mean, he pulled back the curtain. He integrated that into his stage show, and he would do the spiritualist tricks up on the stage, and the audience could see what was happening, but the volunteers that he would bring from the audience, they had no idea. They were thinking that they were having a genuine mediumship experience with Houdini. So I thought that was a very interesting way for him to kind of illustrate, you know, what was going on typically when someone would go visit one of these more famous mediums that he was typically debunking.
You know, that's so true. And the fact is that the people who believed in this, I don't in any way fault them or denigrate them, because they had such a need, or have such a need. There's still people who believe in this, and still there's Canandaigua in New York has a spiritualist community, and there's one in Florida, and people go there. They need some kind of solace. But the people who take advantage of them, that's the ones you have to question. You know, are they really doing something that is a positive service, or is it some sort of cynical way of ripping people off? I ended that chapter by basically saying, you know, everyone has different beliefs, and who can say whose beliefs are right and whose are wrong? And if somehow this brings comfort to people, so be it. But it does seem like that the whole movement was based on fraud.
Well, you know, it certainly does seem that way. And like I said, that kind of brought in a new era, and it created a different kind of scoundrel or rogue, if you would, that have kind of continued on down through today. We're talking with Paul Martin, and the book we're discussing currently is Villains, Scoundrels, and Rogues, and earlier we were talking about Secret Heroes. Links are up at grandarkconspiracy.com for you to get both of those books, and links are also up for you to visit his website, paulmartinbooks.com. We're going to take our last break here, and we'll have Paul on the line with us for...
This is Dan Horde, voice of the Cincinnati Bengals, and you're listening to True Oldies QT 1270, the home of the Bengals in Central Ohio.
8. I deliver your Sunday paper every week.
7. We work on the same floor.
1 in 8 Americans is struggling with hunger.
6. Our kids walk to school together every day,
including millions of children and seniors.
5. We chat in the elevator at work sometimes.
4. I'm your cashier at the grocery store.
Who's the 1 in 8 in your life that needs help? You can make a difference through Feeding America at feedingamerica.org/1in8. A public service announcement brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
This is Dan Tullis, and I just called
Joel Clark,
one of Select Quote Insurance Services Term Life agents.
Hi, Mr. Tullis.
Joel, how does Select Quote save you money on term life insurance?
Well, buying term life insurance is all about choosing the right company. Let's say you take antidepressants or you smoke. All insurance companies are going to price that differently. We'll impartially shop all the companies we represent to find you the best price.
Can you give me an example?
Sure. I just got a man, 40 years old, on cholesterol medication, a $500,000 policy with a highly rated insurance company. His price? $22 a month.
Call 1-800-934-4784 and see how affordable term life insurance can be. That's 1-800-934-4784. 1-800-934-4784. Or go to SelectQuote.com. We shop. You save. Get full details on the example policy at SelectQuote.com/commercials. Your price could vary depending on your health, issuing company, and other factors. Not available in all states.
And we're back. You're listening to the Grand Ark Conspiracy, and we've been discussing secret heroes and villains, scoundrels and rogues, incredible true tales of mischief and mayhem with Paul Martin. Paul, when you set out to write these books, and I know that you're a student of history and a historian yourself, what did this do for you as far as illuminating the human condition and understanding, you know, the paths that we take as we move through our lives?
I think that, the reason I believe people are interested in reading about villains in particular, it's probably the same reason that we like ghost stories and tales about monsters when we're kids. It's because scary characters tend to remind us of, but for most of us, how lucky we are to be safe and secure, and they make us appreciate our own home and our loved ones even more. I think that in terms of the heroes, it's just human nature to the label hero is too readily applied. I mean, everyone from a sports figure to Hollywood celebrities. I mean, there's heroes. It's just everybody's a hero, but there are genuine heroes, and as I said earlier, I think that the for me, the litmus test was, did these people do something that had a lasting and widespread impact? And that was one of the screens, one of the filters I used before I picked anyone for my Heroes book. And I think most of these people, or all these people, really, really fit that category.
So, I mean, as far as sociologically, you know, do we kind of shift the definitions for these to kind of meet our culture, what a villain or a hero is then? I mean, there are some people that were heroes back in, let's say, the 1800s. Would they be considered villains today and vice versa?
Well, I'm sure that's the case. There's probably some people who were thought of as heroes. In fact, in my villains book, I have two characters, Isaac Harris and Max Blank, who were the owners of the sweatshop in New York, a clothing sweatshop, at which the famous Triangle Factory fire took place in 1911, and 146 workers were killed. They were trapped on the ninth floor of this tenement building where these slumlords had their factory. In their day, there were probably a lot of people who looked up to Isaac Harris and Max Blank as really smart businessmen because they were Russian immigrants. They came over here. They pulled themselves up by their bootstraps. They made a lot of money. They had mansions and limousines and chauffeurs and so forth. But looked at it in a historical perspective, they were two of the, they're true villains because they didn't care anything about these people. They put them up there on the ninth floor in this building with no real preparation for escape. There was one rickety fire escape, one rickety one elevator, two stairways which were only wide enough for like one person. And because they were so greedy, they were afraid somebody might steal some fabric from their sweatshop. They kept one of those doors locked. So when a fire broke out below on the floor below, people rushed to the fire escape. It was rusty. It fell nine floors. All those people died. People jammed into that one elevator. It was so overloaded, it quickly broke down. And when the fire started below, it came up the stairway that was open, so they couldn't escape that way. And they ended up 146 women. They were all women, mostly young women, immigrants. This is the typical story, immigrants coming in and being forced to work for next to nothing, 6 or 7 days a week. And most of them jumped out the ninth floor because of the fire and died on the sidewalks below. So here were these businessmen who pulled themselves up by their bootstraps, who made themselves into the model of the American dream success story, and probably up until the point of this fire, they were admired by most people. But their real character came out when this tragedy occurred.
And that was one of the more disturbing things in the book was there was a description by one of the journalists who covered it was the thud dead. Thud dead, thud dead, thud dead. I mean,
oh yeah, the description from the reporter who actually saw these women jumping out said first people thought they were bundles of cloth that people were throwing out the window to try to save them, and some of them were on fire.
Just well, that's just it. I have to wonder. I mean, when I read books about history, I like to kind of put things into the context of today and the context of their time, and I think you do a good job of that and drawing that out of each of these stories. I thought, and that's what makes these characters so fascinating, because I say characters, but they were real people, and they affected the people around them, whether for good or for bad. And some of them were absolutely, like you said, the separation is villains, scoundrels, and rogues. It's necessary for us to kind of couch them this way so we can kind of understand these kind of levels of wrongness that the people are capable of. I think you did an excellent job comprising that and putting that out in the book.
Well, thank you. And I did, I think I might have said this in one way before, but just to reiterate, I mean, I didn't feel like I was writing history. I felt like I was writing personal stories, and the history comes in through the story. So my focus was always on the person that I was talking about and what happened in their life and what they did and how things were affected by their actions. And to me, that's such a more interesting way of approaching history than reading, you know, memorizing dates and names and places, which is the way history seems to be taught, or at least used to be when I was in school.
Well, that's exactly how it's taught, and we get the broad strokes, but we don't get to kind of identify with it and have that connection with it on our own, because we don't have the ability to empathize. We're just seeing names and dates and just, you know, summarization of what happened. We're not getting to see how it affected people, so we don't have that empathy to connect with the history that is unfolding through these individuals' lives. But when you put it in a framework like you have here, you get to understand a little bit about how these people work and at least understand the environment that they were coming out of or even being created by. So that's the thing about these books that makes them, I think, valuable.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Paul, we're at the end here, and I want to give you the last few minutes to tell the audience where they can get the books, anything else that you've got coming down the road for us to be on the lookout for.
Well, of course, they can buy them online through Amazon or Barnes & Noble. They can probably get them in their local bookstores. The book came out in March, so I'm not sure whether every bookstore would still have it in stock, but they can order it. And if they want to find out thumbnail descriptions of all the characters, I have photographs and a paragraph about every character in both books on my website, paulmartinbooks.com. And I give a little bit about my background as a journalist and a little bit about how each of these books originated and sort of an overview. So I think anyone who has an interest in history would find these books of interest because, as I said, that the personal stories really bring history alive. And one of the dust jacket blurbs that I was really proudest of, which is on the front of my Secret Heroes book, was written by a best-selling author, Thomas C. Foster, and he said that the book makes history joyous. And to me, that's the greatest compliment I could have had.
Well, it's really true, Paul, and I appreciate you taking the time out to discuss these books with us here on the Grand Ark Conspiracy. I love the book that the villains, scoundrels, and rogues. I love history, and I love it that it's on a personal level that we can connect with. So it's something that if anybody goes out and buys the book, you're going to be able to connect and understand a little bit more about the human being behind the action. For most cases, hopefully you can identify with some of the characters and villains, scoundrels, and rogues. But for the most part, you get to understand at least the impact on history. Thanks again, Paul. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Dana. Thanks for having me.